WMDX Columbus, Madison's home for real news and great conversation. A Civic Media Station.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. A jury in Los Angeles tonight finding rapper A$AP Rocky not guilty of firing a handgun at a former friend in 2021. Outside the court.
We want to thank God first. You got to thank God first, you know what I'm saying? And I really want to thank the jury for making the right decision, you know?
U.S. and Russian delegations meeting in Saudi Arabia today discussing ending the war in Ukraine. Ukraine and European nations not included at the table. New tonight, the Trump administration cutting funding to organizations that provide free legal service to unaccompanied migrant children. Wendy Young, president of Kids in Need of Defense, called the stop work order devastating. A reversal from Elon Musk's Doge team, a decision to terminate 10% of NASA's workforce, has been reversed. Musk's SpaceX has billions of dollars in contracts with NASA. Two backcountry skiers buried and killed by an avalanche in central Oregon's Happy Valley. Officials say rescuers have recovered the victims. This is ABC News.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
Badgers host Illinois. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. Men's college basketball, it's Wisconsin against Illinois tonight at the Kohl Center in Madison. The Badgers now ranked 11th in the nation after beating Purdue. Greg Gard says his team is better now at managing the shot clock.
That's important. I think it just shows the growth of this team. They couldn't make that play in October or November. They weren't accustomed, I think, to playing together as comfortable as they are right now.
We've learned that Marcus Sedbury is the new general manager of the Badgers football program. Sedbury has served as assistant athletic director at Wisconsin the past 3 years. He'll handle the players and coaches' contracts. Baseball, Brewers left-handed pitcher Nestor Cortez is at spring training in Arizona, trying to learn everyone's name in the clubhouse after 5 years with the Yankees.
Yeah, the names are going to be tough. Obviously, being, you know, so many years in another organization, gold glove caliber defense, and as a pitcher, that's what you want, so I'm very excited for that.
That's Brewers pitcher Nestor Cortez with sports. I'm Mike Clemens.
Ever tried balancing a dozen eggs in one hand while hopping on one foot? Or maybe juggling cats while riding the unicycle? Sounds ridiculous, right? But guess what? That's exactly what texting while driving is like. Your human brain only has the capacity to focus on one thing at a time. So when you're behind the wheel, give driving your undivided attention.
Don't drive distracted. A message brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, Project Yellow Light, and the Ad Council.
Welcome to Madison's Real News and Great Conversation, 92.7 WMDX.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. The chaos doth continue. Yes, even though we're firing air traffic controllers. Yeah, why not? After you had the debacle there in D.C., you got a plane flipped over in Toronto. Yeah, great, great timing. And look, this is, the dismantling of our government and all of the functions of government. So why be surprised? And look, I had a reporter friend reach out to me for a comment. He said, well, what do you think? I go, elections have consequences. This is the consequence of electing people who tell you, we're just going to run the government like a business. And
now we're back, everybody. Welcome back to Wisconsin Decides 2025 here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Rick Smith will be along in a little while. His program continues online, but right now we're going to interrupt our regular programming for a continued special election night coverage. Wisconsin Decides 2025, 4 minutes past the hour here of 9 o'clock. From our world headquarters of Civic Media in downtown Madison, I'm Todd Alball, joined by the political editor at Civic Media and also the founder of the Recombobulation area at recombobulation.com and now a part of the Civic Media World Empire. No, the Civic Media World. We're always proud to have him. Dan Schaefer is here at the desk. Dan, how are you this evening, my friend?
I'm a little discombobulated, but we're piecing it all together. We're recombobulating here on the airwaves at Civic Media.
That's right. As these live events do sometimes a little recombobulating, but as we transition from the governor's biennial budget address into election night, education was part of the governor's address tonight. We heard from both former State Senator Rob Coles and also current State Senator Kelda Royce tonight. Education is going to play a critical part. And now at 5 minutes past the hour, Civic Media News Desk can tell you that with 78% of precincts reporting, Dr. Jill Underley, one of the two Democrats on official Democrats on the ticket, the incumbent DPI secretary, has been declared one of the winners tonight by the Associated Press. Dr. Underley will be one of the people moving on to April 1st.
Yeah, so top two candidates will advance. Looks like it is trending in the direction where Underley, the incumbent, is going to obviously move on here. And it seems like Brittany Kinzer, the education consultant and former charter school executive, looks like it will be, head to head between Underley and Kinzer in the April 1st general election. That's going to be a pretty interesting race, given how the campaign for Kinzer has been run. She was very late at, kind of announcing and declaring for this race and starting the campaign. But she obviously, was able to build a certain level of support. She's had a lot of support from Republicans in this race, particularly as far as the fundraising goes. But it's going to be a pretty interesting race between Kinzer and Underley if the trend lines continue for the results this evening.
Yeah, the only one called officially or technically so far by AP is Dr. Underley, but you're absolutely right, Dan. Brittany Kinzer at last check, 78% reporting. Kinzer's at 35.5%, and Jeff Wright, the other Democrat in the race, is at 27.4%. I give Jeff Wright a lot of credit. I think it's interesting. Craig, keep me honest here, Dan. But at last check, I think Kinzer had raised well north of $100,000 in this race. Underley was at 80-something, and Wright was just shy of $40,000. And, to raise and spend 40 grand and still, come within a respectable showing, I think that says Wright got his message out there, but just at the end of the day, it wasn't enough to knock off the incumbent, and probably not enough, it looks like, to go up against the Republican money being spent on Kinzer.
Yeah, I think, when we saw those reports come in on the finances last week, for me, that was when I really took another look and said, okay, this is going to be a serious race from Kinzer, because I think it was in the pre-primary period, I believe she raised more than $300,000.
Was it $300,000?
And I think it was Politics reported this, that she raised triple the amount of any of her contenders. So, that is obviously going to be a really big deal in this kind of race. And I think with all of the money that is going to be coming into Wisconsin for the Wisconsin Supreme Court race, I know you talked about this quite a bit on your show today, is that, if there are going to be a lot of people showing up to the polls to vote for, conservatives, right wingers voting for Brad Schimmel, stands to reason that many of them might also vote for Brittany Kinzer, because there's been a lot of people upset. A lot of people on the right upset with Dr. Jill Underley. This is the nature of, these types of campaigns, where she's going to face a lot of that fire from being the incumbent. But also the incumbency can give her a certain advantages in this race as well. We know that incumbency can be a really big factor, especially in these down ballot races. I think it was like a 4 or 5 point advantage in Assembly and Senate races last fall. And so I think it might be a similar dynamic for the state superintendent race this spring.
We're going to go to Jimmy Cuska in just a minute. He is standing by to update us on some of these critical races around Wisconsin. There is a primary for La Crosse mayor, and also that very important race in Mauston to exceed levy limits there and to literally keep their school district going. We're going to find out from Jimmy Cuska what's going on there in a minute. But before we do, Dan, I want to finish up on this, because we did talk about this in our show at noon today. There were reports by the Journal Sentinel's Dan Bice yesterday afternoon afternoon that Elon Musk's, well, it's a group of political action committee that's influenced or overseen by Elon Musk. He's putting in just shy of $750,000 in 2 weeks on Wisconsin television for the conservative candidate Brad Schimmel for state Supreme Court against Susan Crawford. That is bound to have an effect on that race. And then vis-a-vis this DPI race, what's your thoughts on this, Dan, as a guy who really knows Wisconsin politics and follows this? It would seem to me that as goes that Supreme Court race, that's going to have a huge effect on who wins the DPI race.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. We're going to see, I think now that we're going to be past the primary, the floodgates are going to be open from some of this spending. And I think we're seeing it from Elon Musk. We're seeing it from the U-lines. I think they might be spending more than Musk, at least in the early going. We saw, you know, finance reports from the Democratic Party of Wisconsin showing George Soros and J.B. Pritzker putting a whole lot of money behind Susan Crawford's bid. And so I think, you know, it is going to be one of those things where we talk about the coattails from a certain candidate. So the coattails from the top of the ticket. And I think the top of the ticket for this spring election race is certainly the Wisconsin Supreme Court race between Schimmel and Susan Crawford. You know, to what extent will they have an impact on what's happening in the DPI race as well? I think that's going to be really interesting because when you have, you know, people going door to door campaigning for Brad Schimmel, you usually have the literature for some of the other candidates as well. So the folks who are campaigning for Brad Schimmel might also have a pamphlet for Brittany Kinzer, talk about school choice, talk about that approach as well that they have been advocating for kind of more on the right in Wisconsin. And so, you know, the DPI race has not historically been a close one. I think it was a 15-point margin that Underly won by. Tony Evers, when he was state superintendent, regularly won with more than 60% of the vote in those races. You know, I still think Underly is going to be the favorite coming out of this primary, but I think we might have a dynamic where this could be the closest state superintendent race that we've had in Wisconsin in quite some time.
You've written about this in the recombobulation area, and we don't need to get into the whole thing, but you're an expert on ticket splitting in Wisconsin. These are these unique Wisconsin voters, like in this past election, people who pulled the lever or marked the ballot for both Donald Trump and Tammy Baldwin. We've seen it before with Ron Johnson and Tony Evers. Thank you very much. But ticket splitters, I don't get the sense, at least early on, that we're going to have people voting for Brad Schimmel and Jill Underly. I just don't see that.
Yeah, that would be a very different type of ticket splitting than
because I don't think people know about the DPI. Yeah. They don't think about the DPI race, and it seems anybody who's motivated, to your point, I've seen a lot of this on social media across Wisconsin, conservatives, Republicans going out and having pamphlets or yard signs for the contingent. And so if they're coming out to vote for Brad Schimmel, a conservative, a MAGA voter, probably just going to go ahead and vote for the MAGA conservative candidate for DPI. They're not going to take the time to be involved getting to know about Jill Underly, or is that just Todd looking at a crystal ball?
I that does make a lot of sense, but I do think, you know, the Jeff Wright factor here, right? Mm-hmm. Because he's got, as I take a look at the results here, 86% of the vote from the AP, Underly at 37%, Kinzer at 35%, and Jeff Wright at 27%. 27% is a pretty big number, right?
Yeah,
so I wonder if the strategy from the Kinzer campaign, as they, you know, if they're advancing to the general election here, will be to make some overtures to some of those Jeff Wright voters who might lean to the left, but might not exactly be happy with the job Jill Underly's doing.
That's a great point, because Jeff Wright's main platform or plank was, hey, I'm a Democrat, but I live in a purple county, Sauk County, just below Wisconsin Dells, for those that might not know, which is a purple county. I have to work with everyone to be successful. That was his main bipartisanship, basically, was his main plank. So I think you're onto something. Kinzer's people could try to pick up on that.
And then again, you look at the other side of it. You know, folks on the left might think that, okay, you add up the 27% from Wright with the 37% from Underly, and it's going to be a blowout. So,
as they say, time will tell. Let's turn our attention now to Jimmy Cuska, who is standing by. He has many hats here at Civic Media. One of them is the news director at WLAK. Pardon me. That's Amory, our lacrosse station there, WLCX. I get my L's and C's mixed up. LCX there, a news director. Jimmy is standing by, watching the important race for Mauston School Board, exceeding the limits, among other things. Jimmy, good evening to you. What can you tell us?
So we have four of the five school referendum votes mostly in Lincoln County, with Tomahawk is the one that's not in. But I think everybody's wondering what's happening in Mauston. It's a district that said that if they don't pass it, they had two referendum fail last year, operational referendum that failed. And they said, if we don't pass this one this spring, we're going to run out of money after the 26-27 school year. They've already planned on making a lot of cuts to extracurriculars, to staff, just to keep things going. They kept lowering the amounts from the first two referenda last year. The one in November was pretty close. It was in the high 40s. This one today, with the unofficial results in, overwhelmingly passes, almost 2-1, in fact, in the reporting, at 2,044 votes to 1,034 votes. So Mauston voters, I think this time, heard the message loud and clear. There was a very, very active campaign in Mauston to get people out to vote for this. This really had the Save Our School effect to it, Save Our Community effect to it, and people really turned out for this particular school referendum.
Jimmy, you happen to be a school board member yourself in Southwest Wisconsin. You know this better than anybody else. Do you think that there was this effect of well, you know, I might disagree with school funding on a partisan sense for everybody else, but when it comes to my school district, I don't want that dissolved because our local sports, our local arts programs are important to our community?
Yeah, there's a lot of factors. There's community pride, obviously. It's a major employer in your community. You know, for logistics, you know, childcare, things like that, you don't have to drive as far. If you have to drive out of, say, Mauston, you have to take your kids to New Lisbon, for example. Now you have to commute to a whole other city for schools and, you know, those kind of things, sports, all the extra activities. But also, there's a tax impact, because if you dissolve a school district, it's not like those taxes go away. Public schools are still going to get tax money from you. It just, you won't have one in your town anymore. You'll have to go somewhere else. And that, those districts that are picking up the students that you're no longer having a school for in your city, those schools now have to levy that tax from you so they can pay for transportation, to expand facilities if needed, to add staff, to do those things. So, you know, it's not like your taxes go down if you don't have a school district. Those taxes still exist. But Mauston was certainly one that I think a lot of people watched, just because they had said they may dissolve in 2 years without the referendum passing today.
Just about less than 2 minutes before we have to step away here for a break. But, Jimmy, another big race that you've been watching for us tonight is in the city of La Crosse. There is a mayoral primary there. Any results in yet on that one?
Yep, La Crosse is 100% in. They're usually one of the fastest counties to get results in my experience. And I think the mayoral primary was very interesting. There were four candidates, all with pretty varied backgrounds, which made it very interesting. The top vote-getter was a community organizer and volunteer, Shondell Washington Spivey, who is also the first one that announced this candidacy, and he came away with 30% of the vote. The second place, though, because only two of the four advanced, second place was between the city council president, Chris Kahlo, and Vicky Markison, who lost by fewer than 200 votes to the current mayor, Mitch Reynolds, back in 2021. And it was Kahlo by 45 votes.
Wow.
Before the canvassing, obviously, but 45 votes are what separates second and third place. So Kahlo will, if that were to hold, would be the one advancing with Washington Spivey to the spring election. The fourth candidate, Ellie McLoon, a real estate developer, had a different tone than the other three candidates, spoke about investing more in police services and bringing sort of a non-political outsider perspective to the office. She trailed the others by more than 600 votes. So it'll be Washington Spivey and Kahlo, the city council president, that would advance.
All right. Well, stay with us, Jimmy Cuska. We'll have more from him on school referendums and mayoral results as well. Dan Schaefer is here for the recombobulation area. And we have a second candidate for DPI secretary. The results are in. We'll give them to you. Stay with us. You're listening to Wisconsin Decides 2025 on the Civic Media Radio Network.
Place together. Listen, the winning will take care of itself. We just have to get everyone involved.
In interscholastic sports, we celebrate what makes every one of us unique. And in the pursuit of a common goal, everyone in the huddle, in the bleachers, and in the community comes together. This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabe.
What celebrity would you like to hug? It's International Hug Day. I wouldn't say Josh Brolin is like my favorite actor, but he's got like a quiet macho-ness to him. Actor Glenn Morshower joins us now.
My self-esteem was jolted when you did not mention me as your hugging preference.
I didn't want to rush it. I just want to see how. Let's just dip our toes in the water here and see what kind of relationship develops, shall we?
Nightlight with Pete Schwabe. Weeknights from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. The Todd Alba Show.
Trigvi, great to have you here as always. Donald Trump is calling for foreign assistance and nation building. Did they vote to have their tax dollars going to Gaza?
Gary, thanks for calling. Let's see.
I'm a MAGA guy. I'm not sure what he's talking about. He wants to demo the whole country there, Gaza, and make it into a resort. I'm against it. I'm confused, too.
Right? You and I agree on that completely.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekdays, noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Imagine home. The smell of coffee, the sound of a lawnmower, the sun's warmth on your face. Free to be yourself, surrounded by love that helps you grow. This is a place to call home. That's an American dream we all deserve. But in 50% of U.S. states, you could legally be denied housing if you are LGBTQ+. Get the facts and hear real stories at lovehasnolabels.com. Brought to you by Love Has No Labels and the Ad Council.
And welcome back to Civic Media's continuing coverage of Wisconsin Decides 2025 here at the Civic Media World Headquarters in downtown Madison, Wisconsin. I'm joined by our co-anchor, the founder of the Recombobulation Area, and also Civic Media's political editor, Dan Schaefer. Glad to have you along. 21 minutes past the hour of 9 o'clock here on a Tuesday evening, February 18th. Going to go back to Jimmy Cuska, our news director for lacrosse, in just a moment, among other things. But Jimmy does a lot for us here at Civic Media. But first of all, Dan, want to get to more results here on a Tuesday evening. We've already had one of the two candidates decided earlier, announced, the AP called it, for the incumbent, Dr. Jill Underley, one of the two Democratic candidates running for DPI secretary, Underley, the incumbent. And now, Dan, we have a second one, as you surmised.
Yes, we've got Brittany Kinzer, who's going to advance to the general election along with Jill Underley. So we will have it. It's going to seem like a very partisan race in this one, in the nonpartisan, in name only race for state superintendent. So we will have Jill Underley advancing. She currently has, with 91% of the votes counted, AP estimates that she is at 37.2%, Kinzer at 35.3%, Jeff Wright coming in third at 27.6%. His campaign just sent out a statement, and I'll read just the first paragraph of it here. While our campaign did not advance, I'm grateful for the conversations I was able to have over the past few years about the future of K-12 public education in Wisconsin, for the support of those who voted for me and for my family who stood by me as well. So now we have it. We have a general election, Underley versus Kinzer.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a great general election. I'd be remiss before we move on if we had the opportunity to have Jeff Wright on our program midday. I'm just very impressed with the guy. I think that he is the kind of person that Wisconsin voters are looking for, someone that says, yes, I have a political leaning, but I want to work with everybody in my community to get results. And I hope that people like him continue to keep running, because we need more of that, if I can editorialize for a minute, in Wisconsin politics.
Yeah, I do wonder what the race would have been like if Brittany Kinzer did not jump into it. And yeah. I think, you know, she declared very, very close to the deadline. I'm always interested in debates that don't fit along clean partisan lines. Yeah. And I think a Underley Wright campaign would have been that type of race, where you're not necessarily talking about a right versus left, red versus blue type of dynamic, where you're talking about the issues, talking about what really matters to people, and not just getting into your partisan camps. But unfortunately,
a race for another day. Yeah, exactly. Let's head back to Southwest Wisconsin and our very own Jimmy Cuska standing by. Jimmy, we appreciate you staying with us here on election night. Again, if you just want to reiterate that the big race, I think, particularly for our listeners in Richland Center, Southwest Wisconsin, also Wisconsin Rapids, WFHR there, a lot of those teams, those sports teams, play against Mauston in tournaments and whatnot. So recap, if you would, please, Jimmy, that referenda to keep Mauston going and also the lacrosse race as well.
Sure. So, you know, Mauston, a community that hosts a lot of other sporting events with some of its, you know, its baseball diamond and everything like that, too. They had two referendums last year that failed. The one in November that failed was pretty close. It was pretty close on the no side. So in the lead up to this spring primary referendum, a lot of it was talked about saving the district and really helping save the community. The messaging was that if the district didn't pass this referendum, this operating referendum, even after all the cuts and the budget moves they had made, that they would actually run out of money after the 26-27 school year. Well, it is an overwhelming result, 2-1 the margin in favor of the referendum passing in Mauston. About 67% yes to 33% no. So Mauston's referendum is one of the three that I have checked off as passed here tonight. Three out of the five I have as passed. Do have one referendum that failed, and that was Kenosha, the largest referendum by price tag in the state at $115 million. That was a five-year operating referendum. That one failed at 56% no. And then there's one in Waterford Union. There's still one big ward to result coming there yet. Still waiting on that part of it, but currently yes is in front, 55-45 there. The other two are in northern Wisconsin, Tomahawk and Northland Pines. Both of those were essentially continuations of existing non-recurring referendums that had expired. So these were basically to pick up where they had left off with those for three more years, and both of those passed pretty easily up north.
Very, very interesting about the Kenosha one going down. That'll be a particular interest for our folks down at WRJN in Racine and Kenosha down there. Quickly, Jimmy, again, just to recap the winners there in the lacrosse Merrill primary race and any other races you're watching tonight you think our listeners across the state should know about.
Sure. Lacrosse had three primaries mainly tonight, and the big one was mayor. Four candidates for mayor seeking the office that is being vacated by Mitch Reynolds, who declined to run for re-election. This also comes amidst the city council creating a city administrator position that would take over some of the duties for mayor. That position has not yet gone all the way through, but it is very far along in the process where they would split the mayor's office duties with this new city administrator position. And all the candidates that ran supported that city administrator position, for the record. But it was very close between three candidates at the top. And the top vote getter was Shondell Washington Spivey, who came away with 30% of the vote. And then at 27% of the vote, Chris Kahlo, the current city council president, had 45 more votes than Vicky Markison, who ran 4 years ago for mayor and lost by under 200 votes to Reynolds. So at the moment, before canvassing, with the unofficial results, it'll be Washington Spivey facing Kahlo in the spring general election for mayor. Ellie McLoon, who is a real estate agent worker in the La Crosse area, came in fourth with about 17% of the vote. And again, as I had said in the previous segment, was kind of running with that outsider perspective as part of that race. There was an open seat on the city council. The two candidates advancing there for District 7, Matt Keel and Gary Podesky. And then the La Crosse school board race was seven candidates for six spots on the ballot in the spring. And it was made a bit easier in a sort of unfortunate circumstance when one of the candidates posted on Friday that they were being targeted with online harassment, a lot of homophobic comments. So he said that he was withdrawing his name from consideration. That was Sam Morris. The other six candidates all had more votes tonight, so they all will move on in that one. But sort of unfortunate, the political climate and things like that, that's something that happened in La Crosse. But other than that, the six candidates are on the ballot for the spring in that race.
Jimmy, we appreciate your great work as always, great reporting. Anything else that listeners need to know before we let you go?
Sure. I'll just say on the school referendum front, we only had five tonight, right? And that it appears three or four of the five will pass. Mm-hmm. We have 89 more of these coming up in the spring general election. So we have a lot of school referendums on the ballot coming up on April 1st.
Well, Jimmy, great work tonight. Thank you so much, my friend. Have a great evening. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Jimmy Cuska there from our Western Wisconsin Bureau covering lacrosse and Southwest Wisconsin as well. Dan, a couple of quick takeaways there of what Jimmy is saying. Number one, how unfortunate that in today's political climate, these just hateful type of rhetoric in campaigns has reached the local school board level.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate. And I think it discourages people from participating, from getting involved. And I think, you know, it's always a challenge to get people to get up off the sidelines and get into the game and run for office. And stories like that are certainly discouraging.
And certainly, as Jimmy said, lots more to come. April 1st is our next election right around the corner. As we say, be a voter, go to Wisconsin Vote, myvote.wi.gov, myvote.wi.gov. Of course, Civic Media will be covering the next big debate here for the Wisconsin State Supreme Court. Susan Crawford taking on Brad Schimmel. That will be March 12th. Also happens to be the first night of Big Ten men's basketball tournament. But no, stay tuned with us for the debate for Supreme Court on March 12th. And, of course, that DPI race Dan Schaefer is setting up between, once again, a Democrat Republican underly taking on Ginzer.
Well, we've got 42 days to go before the April 1st general election. You think it's going to be a busy 42 days, Mr. Alba?
It'll be discombobulating, Dan Schaefer. You can help us recombobulate at recombobulation.com. Dan Schaefer, always a pleasure, my friend, working with you. Thanks for great work tonight. Great reporting.
Thanks to you as well. Thanks to all of you out there.
It takes everybody to do this. To our owner CEO, Sage Weil, Vice President Corey Hartman, Digital Director David Highland, Director of Operations Luke Mathers, General Manager of WMDX Catherine Lake, Jimmy Kuska, our News Director at WLCX News, our Network Engineer Chris Casper, also Senior Producer Aaron Zommers, and for Civic Media's Political Editor, my co-host tonight, Dan Schaefer. I'm Todd Allball. Thank you all for joining us. There'll be much more across the network tomorrow. Now back to regular schedule. Program. You've been listening to Wisconsin Decides 2025 on the Civic Media Radio Network.
Conversation 92.7 WMDX. You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Partly cloudy for tonight, lows to around 10 below, wind chills to 20 and 25 below. Increasing clouds for tomorrow, highs of 10 to 15 above. And with sunshine, we climb to the low 20s on Thursday and a warming trend into the weekend. Currently, it's 2 degrees.
The John and Gordy Show.
Go back to an earlier era before the right dominated the national storytelling. You go back to somebody like Frank Capra. He was masterful at telling that story about the little guy. Mm. That heroic figure who had nothing but worked hard, looked out for other people, cared about family, and made a better life. And that kind of storytelling has vanished.
Weekday mornings 6 till 8 on 92.7 WMDX.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Got to tell you, I was surprised at the number of responses I got from the idea that Trump was going to actually just pave over the Rose Garden. You know, what's that song? You know, pave over paradise, put up a parking lot. Yeah, evidently he wants to have a, you know, like a paved area like they have at Mar-a-Lago to entertain. You know, no sense in having, you know, roses. Shocked? I'm not even a little bit. Anyway, we're here to share some thoughts on the craziness or as military.com put it. And I tell you, I love the frame. Infinite nightmares at once. It's what we're living through. I've asked my good friend, former Ohio congressman and political analyst, Bob Ney, to come share some thoughts. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you, Rick.
So infinite nightmares at once. Military.com's article headed off as they talk about all of the veterans' data that has been swept up in the Musk takeover of the Treasury Department. And a lot of concern about what they're going to do with that data. But it's interesting, that frame, infinite nightmares at once. It's kind of, it's apropos for what we're living through.
Well, now, I'm old, Rick. So what's the current young generation Z?
Yeah, Z.
Is that it?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I forget.
The X, Zoomers.
Baby boomers. Zoomers. I know baby boomers, and that's the only one I know. So generation Z. And I saw an article today, which was really interesting, and it said 30% of Generation Z are now angry at what's happened with the election of Trump. And one of the lines was, don't you realize that's called you need to vote?
Yeah, yeah.
Versus after effect. I mean, it's so rapid, the change in D.C. And, of course, the problem that everybody's going to have, in particular the Democratic side, is twofold. One, some of these, as these items come out, people do say, wow, you know, it's like the $6,000 toilets, right? Years ago and things.
Right.
And people will grab onto that. Now, some of this will then filter out amongst the heartland of America. And then people will say, well, I didn't think this was going to happen. I don't think I want that, but I want this. Well, there's not sort of a choice, you know, when you take a buzzsaw to something, this is what happens. Now, of course, DOGE is not a congressionally established entity, so it can do these things only by relating to the executive, the president. Here's what happens, now you need to lay off. Here's what happens in that agency, now you need to go in and cut. And of course, there's a 1974 Impoundment Act, which was created because of Richard Nixon, just willy-nilly doing away with congressionally authorized programs. That's going to happen again. Now, the Congressional 1974 Impoundment Act, Rick, as you know, is only as valid and is only as capable an act as it can be if it's enforced.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
So who enforces it? I'm going to throw that out there. Who enforces it?
Yeah, the executive branch is supposed to, but they're not going to do it.
That's what I'm saying. So there's going to be a series of Supreme Court decisions, but not all of them will go to the Supreme Court.
No, but even still, even if the Supreme Court does decide, do you think this administration cares? Do you think the Musks of the world care what the rule of law is? You know, I saw a post over on Twitter from the real Donald Trump, and he says, he who saves his country does not violate any law. And, you know, he's not just talking about himself here. He's talking about anyone who, as long as you're saving, it's like that whole, you know, the tree of liberty must be watered with the blood of tyrants and patriots. It's that kind of verbiage that gets me to believe that this is more of a call of action to go out and break the law and to break things up, as long as you're doing it, you know, to save the country, of course.
Well, and also there's a lot of moving pieces to this. There's the foreign entity side of it and what we're doing. There's the domestic, and then there's the budget. And the only thing that can make the executive stronger, the White House, is if the congressional side can't come to terms with the budget process, which there isn't even a budget process. These are continuing resolutions.
Right.
Let's remember something. They're working on reconciliation. They're working on, in March, that's the deadline, on fixing what was supposed to happen last year.
Right.
This gives a path wide enough for a Mack truck to ride through for any president. Now, we have a new president. Biden would, you know, have reacted differently, or Obama or Bush. And now we have Trump, who reacts differently than we've ever seen in modern times. But the Congress itself, as long as it cannot function like it's supposed to, this invites executive authority, power, executive actions, and even signing statements, which nobody talks about, where the president makes a signature when he votes on a law, and it tells the agencies not to follow what Congress has passed. This has been going on for a long time. Now it's on steroids.
Yeah. No, it's something we used to talk about a lot during the W. Bush years, and has continued all through. But what do you say? Because obviously the deadline is March 14th, the potential government shutdown. What if Trump just says, you know, I don't believe in a ceiling. I don't believe in you know this. We've cut all this spending. We're not honoring this stuff. We're just going to keep the government open, and don't care what Congress says.
Well, it's going to be an interesting deal of what happens in Congress. Of course, the Senate, I'm not even going to talk about it because they have a margin. It's not real comfortable, but it's comfortable, if that makes sense. They have a margin of votes. They can lose one or two. They can lose Mitch McConnell, you know, whatever. Now, let's talk about the House, though. And for the Democratic side, when it comes to policy, they're going to have to make a decision. Do they want to go along and not have the government shut down? Or do they want to let the Republicans make that decision? And if the government shuts down, it's the Republicans' problem and not the Democratic side's problem. Although I will give this observation, and this is retail politics. And you know, you know it, you've been involved for years. You know, I call it the retail politics, the street politics, and the people politics. And what I'm referring to is the fact that it's not good enough to say oligarchs, democracy's done as we know it. You have to give examples. And on top of it, you have to have an alternative. And that's where the Democratic side has to decide quickly, are they going to be part of an agreement to keep the government open? If they are part of an agreement, is it going to be a wishy-washy agreement where they say, yeah, we don't want to shut down the government? Or are they going to get what they believe, the Democratic side, that their values are? Are they going to get that into a piece of legislation to continue the government? These are some decisions they're going to have to make. If they're not going to go with the Republicans to, you know, quote, save the speaker if he can't get the votes, because his margin's one or two votes, then they have to decide, as the government may shut down, what their answer to that's going to be. Of course, the executive has to deal with it. And let's see how Trump handles it. Frankly, I'm not sure that the Trump administration is going to wring their hands if it shuts down.
No, I don't think so either. But you know, if you're the Democrats, and I agree with you, you've got to come out with that alternative vision. It's what I've been saying all along. The solutions will come out of the suffering of their savagery. The more things that they do, the more things they get away with, the more people are going to be harmed by it, the more it will become clear of what those solutions should be. And Democrats have to go out there and have that vision of what the alternative looks like and stand on those principles. Republicans have done that for years. I mean, you were part of one of the first waves of it with the contract on America. I put the on America because, again, I think that was the beginning of where we are today.
Well, and look, we had a balanced budget movement. Bill Clinton came willingly or part willingly or whatever, you know, into it and became part of it. In fact, I'll tell you this, Rick, if I heard it once, I heard it 100 times of people beating their fists down in closed door Republican meetings saying, he's getting the credit for it. He's getting the credit for it. Well, he went along with us, or we went along with him, or we went along together, right? But we had this mantra of what we were going to do when it came to balancing the nation's budget. But when we did it, we at least did it by agency, and you had the amendment process, and Democrats did get amendments. And so sometimes we got votes, in the budget process. This time, this is not, and I can't stress this enough, this is not a budget process. This is just, you know, we're going to cut and we're going to do this and we're going to do that. It's not laying everything out to get a chance. It's just saying we're going to rescind $2.5 trillion, which I'm not against the balanced budget, but how are you going to do that? Yeah. Who pays for it? How do you make it work? At least when, you know, Clinton was there with us, we laid it all out, and it was done in the sunshine of what you were going to do. That's not the case now. It's just, you know, who can do what first on these broad scale basis, which really do not work out to say how the government's going to function after that.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what Schumer and Jeffries do as the leadership of the party. It's going to be interesting to see how they handle this, because there are a lot of people looking to them for leadership, and there doesn't seem to be any. There doesn't seem to be any direction, and I think that's a real problem.
Well, also, too, I read an article how a lot of the base, I mean, it was generic, the Democratic base, is flooding the offices with, you know, do something, do something. But if you look at what happened, I mean, people have to not forget this on the Democratic side, I would say. The Republican side, they're surely analyzing it. A lot of people didn't come out to vote on the Democratic side. Yeah. And elections have consequences. So a lot of people may be mad at their Democratic members of Congress, but they, you know, they didn't give them the majority. So it's going to be tough to immediately this year for the Democratic side to do something. So they've got to put their, you know, thoughts together and get on the same page, at least to draw back in people that went another direction. I'm talking mainly about working people.
Yeah, or just stayed home. And one of those issues was, you know, I had a lot of people, I can't vote for Genocide Joe. And, you know, talking about Gaza and obviously about Ukraine. And now we see Trump has got, he's got plans for Gaza. He's got plans for Ukraine. And I don't think they're necessarily good plans.
Well, Bibi Netanyahu has embraced the Gaza plan because he has two ministers, Smotrich and Gavir, who they want the Palestinians gone. Now, that doesn't mean every Israeli follows that guideline. A lot of Israelis know this would be a very painful process for Israel just to try to move 2.5 million people somewhere else, and it could be a disastrous prospect for Jordan and Egypt, because people say to me, well, why don't they take them? They're Arabs. Well, okay, Germans and English are Europeans, right? Why don't, you know, if something happens, move all of Germany into England? After all, they're Europeans, aren't they? Well, this is the same scenario. There are differences in cultures and people. So as this plan's laid out there and Netanyahu's embracing it, it's interesting to see the dynamics of what's going to happen. Now, in theory, are we going to, United States going to own a piece of land overseas and move 2.5 million people? No. But this is causing a reaction now of people to at least begin to discuss what really is going to happen, and the Arab nations are going to have to weigh into it. And then you have the Ukraine and Russia. You have negotiations starting as we speak in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Mohammed bin Salman, who's not technically the king, but he is the king, is hosting this event, and it'll be between us and Russia. And the comment was made that Saudi Arabia will be an active participant in this entire deal, right? Now, on the other hand, we have our special emissary who's going to the Ukraine to conduct, quote, parallel conversations. Then you have the United Kingdom who said, well, we're willing to put troops on the ground, which maybe somebody should have said that a couple years ago.
Yeah.
We're willing to put troops on the ground to defend the Ukraine. This is England. So you have, you know, this entire strange dynamic. Now, I think generically that President Trump wants two deals. How they come out, I don't know. Remember when he told the Congress, Rick, that he wanted a perfect bill, then later said, but you can have two of them. Well, you can have three of them, as long as he can say, I got something. I think the foreign affairs situation is the same thing. I'm not sure it matters what comes out, but that the Trump administration will be able to say, well, we took care of those two problems. Joe Biden let him sit. We finished it. That's off of our plate. That's what I think's happening.
No, that's part of his thing. And I was reading an article from talking about, it was actually talking about J.D. Vance's speech overseas, and you know how it was not well received. I don't know that you can go into Germany and tell Germans that they're treating Nazis poorly, but that's what he kind of did. But you know, this, I think it was one of the Polish ministers or something, and he was explaining what he thought Trump was doing, and there's some Russian phrase for what he was saying. It's just you push and you push and you push, and then you settle for something less. And he was basically calling Trump a bully, and that they were going to have to figure out how to poke the bully back in the chest, because I don't know, the globe is going to take 4 years of what we've seen. But, you know, it's going to be interesting to see.
Well, look, the first person, of course, to visit was Bibi Netanyahu, you know, and he came out with a brand new plan that even he didn't think of, which is to move 2.5 million people. Even Bibi didn't ask for that, right?
Yeah.
But he came out with it. then Prime Minister Modi of India. And India is a really great potential ally of ours for so many reasons. They like us. They are a democracy. You know, they have had problems with China. India has. What happened with Modi? Number one, when the illegals were brought back, the Modi government said, okay, they violated American law, bring them back. That's number one. Number two, Modi already started to reduce some tariffs before he got on the plane to D.C. to arrive saying, I've reduced some tariffs. So there is a world reaction right now to Trump because he will throw out, well, I'm going to, you know, tariff everything you own. Well, okay, well, maybe we better do this and that before we go to D.C. So there is that interaction, which is fascinating. And that's why J.D. Vance did what he did. He went over to play the bad guy. This is good guy, bad guy, cop thing, except it's kind of bad cop, more than the follow-up of the good cop. But that's what's going on here, and that's why J.D. Vance, you know, did what he did. Hegseth came out and almost, you know, ruined part of it, but that's, you know, because he has no experience. J.D. Vance was a planned event.
Well, I'm sure it was. You don't go doing that off the cuff. I get that, but at the end of the day, I guess it'll see how this plays out. I'm concerned we're setting ourselves up for a fall.
It could be.
Lastly, I got to get your thoughts on the firings. You know, Trump went through real, and they fired, you know, I think someone said a quarter of most agencies they were supposed to go get. One of them being one of the people who take care of our nuclear arsenal, only to go, oh, gee, we need those people. How can we find them? Thoughts on dismantling government piece by just firing people arbitrarily?
Well, again, what's happened is with $35, $36 trillion debt, and the Congress's inability for years, not just now, but under Bush forward, inability for years, and the presidents, all of them, because we got to remember Trump actually added more to the deficit than Biden did, but Biden added to the deficit. They all do. And both parties do. And when it gets to this level, people are able to, and the Trump administration is able to say, well, we have to do this because the House of Cards is going to fall, so we've got to go in and do this. But they're going to find out there's ways to do things that work and ways to do things that don't work. And some of it may sound good. We're going to freeze out, you know, all of this until you realize, well, we've got to run our nuclear capabilities and we have to have people to do that. So this is going to adjust even without court battles, but I'll go back to the fact that Congress needs to do the budget process again to lay all of these things out. It can't be just, you know, the Freedom Caucus saying cut $2.5 trillion right now, no matter what it does. We didn't get into this mess overnight, and we're not going to get out of it overnight.
No, you're absolutely
and
right.
To make immediate rescissions that absolutely don't take into account how the government needs to function, it's not going to be, it might look nice. It's not going to be the way out of this.
I'm with you. Bob, appreciate the time. As always, good stuff. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Our good friend Bob Ney. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back to wrap things up. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. This day in labor history, the year was 1834. That was the day that one of the earliest labor newspapers in the country published its first edition in New York City. The Man was a paper aimed at trade unionists. It sold for only a penny. The masthead of the paper was unique. Images of a plowshare, sickle, rake, an axe, hatchet, a saw, a hammer, an auger, a square, and other tools were combined to spell out the letters T-H-E-M-A-N. The newspaper was short-lived, however. It folded in 1835. But the Man was just one example of a growing number of working-class newspapers. The concerns and opinions of working people were often neglected by the mainstream press. In 1828, the Mechanics Free Press was founded in Philadelphia. The paper declared that the working class are the blood, bone, and sinew of the nation. Its circulation grew to 2,000, but it closed 3 years after it began publishing. 50 labor papers started in the 1820s and early 1830s. Most were printed in industrialized northeastern cities. Perhaps the most well-known paper of the time was the Working Class Advocate from New York City. The paper published working people's news for two decades. The years between 1880 and 1940 are considered the golden age of working class journalism in the United States. Thousands of union and radical papers operated during this era. Many of these papers were published in the workers' native languages as immigrants were a growing part of the American workforce. Many unions published their own newspapers or journals. These papers were a vital part of organizing the labor movement, especially in an era before television and the internet. Today, the labor press continues to be a powerful voice for working people. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, email me, Rick at the Rick Smith Show. So Bob brought up Gen Z. And look, it's easy to beat up on younger generations, as Bob said. I only know about the baby boom generation. Bob's a boomer. I'm a Gen X guy. So again, we all look at each other with a little bit jaundiced eye. I think baby boomers kind of destroyed a good portion of what the greatest generation built. Now, but hey, we can have that argument. What I love is the intergenerational fighting, though. Instead of going, hey, we're all working people, we should maybe all try and figure out how, you know, what works for all of us. Yeah, I don't know. I came across this article over at the Business Insider, and I love these articles, with the headline of, "My dad worked for the railroad and retired on a pension. I didn't know how lucky he was until I planned my own retirement." I didn't know. And it's true. Didn't know. They go through this very short article. And it talks about how the father was employed by the railroad, paid into the railroad retirement program, which was a New Deal era program. Thank you, FDR. And it was one of those things that made sure that from the moment you retired to the moment you died, you received a pension. You received a check every month. And when you died, your spouse got a survivor's benefit. And they got that till that person died. It was retirement security. That's what it was. And, you know, this little article talks about how, you know, the father, you know, worked the whole life and, you know, didn't worry about the pension, didn't do any planning, just got to be old enough and retired and the pension was there. Didn't have to figure out how to manage stock markets and risky investments and shysters trying to, you know, sell you, you know, these get rich quick schemes. No, this guy just worked his life and was able to live in dignity once he got to retirement age. And it, as this article said, my dad's pension was enough to cover his cost of living for the 20 plus years he lived after retiring. His pension meant that retirement concerns were off his mind and out of his hands. He wasn't worried about outliving his funds. He wasn't concerned with risky investments, stock market plunges, and interest rates. As far as I can tell, she wrote, he did zero financial planning beyond saving some of his income, but it worked well for him. Sounds like a fantasy scenario to me and those like me. And you go, no, not fantasy, policy. Didn't talk about the fact that this was a government-run program, a policy that was put into place by Democrats and FDR back in 35 to ensure that workers had retirement security. And, you know, maybe they saved a little bit of their own money. You know, pension, savings, Social Security. Now, the railroad folks didn't get Social Security. That was written out. But they got a very generous pension. Also, because their union, their union fought for good pay and for money to go into that pension fund. This is one of those, I know it sounds like a secret. I know it sounds amazing. But hey, Gen Z, how that was able to happen, and everybody else, it was able to happen because smart policy, strong unions, and workers who understood the value of both. We need to get back there. And these kind of stories, it'd be great if the person writing them would write that in there. That, hey, this was good government. This was strong worker organizing. Might be a good correction. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast. Thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
This is 92.7 WMDX Columbus, Madison's home for real news and great conversation. A Civic Media station.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. A jury in Los Angeles finding rapper A$AP Rocky not guilty of firing a handgun at his former friend on a Hollywood street in 2021. Just 3 hours of deliberations, the artist, whose real name is Rakim Mayers, outside court.
I'm just so thankful. This is crazy right now. This whole experience has been crazy for the past 4 years, but I'm thankful. Nonetheless, I'm thankful, and this, we'll be blessed to be here right now, to be a free man talking to y'all.
Rocky could have legally gotten up to 24 years in prison with guilty verdicts. Top officials from both Russia and the U.S. meeting for 4 hours in Saudi Arabia's capital. It was the highest-level engagement between the countries since Moscow sent troops into Ukraine nearly 3 years ago. President Trump today signing an executive order aiming to lower the cost of and expand access to in vitro fertilization. Brazil's prosecutor general charging former leader Jair Bolsonaro with attempting a coup to stay in power and agreeing to poison his successor. This is ABC News. A native